Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the surprise resignation of the U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, whose sudden departure has led to feverish speculation. Barbara Crissett, the former UN bureau chief for the New York Times, who is now the UN correspondent for The Nation, joins us to discuss the extent to which Haley was forced out of a job by Secretary of State Pompeo and National Security Advisor Bolton. We'll assess whether, since Trump said to Haley today in the Oval Office that, quote, hopefully you'll be coming back at some point in a different capacity, you can have your pick, that Trump might dump Pence and put Haley on the 2020 ticket as his VP. Conversely, because she is seen by the White House as being too close to Mike Pence, he might find a way to dump Trump and take Haley on as his vice president in 2020. There is also the speculation that the Attorney General Jeff Sessions will soon be fired and replaced by Senator Lindsey Graham, and that the governor of South Carolina would then appoint Nikki Haley to fill out Graham's term in the Senate until 2020. We'll also get an appraisal of her tenure at the UN and how diplomats from around the world found her as the representative of Trump's hostile, xenophobic administration that wants to undo the very purpose of the UN, which is global cooperation and multilateralism, and roll back the clock to a world torn apart by the passions and perils of patriotism and nationalism, which Trump recently advocated at the UN. Then we'll get an analysis of the latest report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that issued an even more alarming warning of the rapid pace of global warming, which has eclipsed earlier projections of catastrophic and irreversible damage if temperatures were to rise to 3.6 degrees by 2040, to now show that the dire effects will come sooner at the 2.7 degree mark. Robert Stavins, a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at Harvard's Kennedy School and the lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, joins us. Then finally, we will speak with Aziz Huq, a professor of law at the University of Chicago who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of a new book just out, How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. We will discuss how the new Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh is likely to use his position on the court to be a zealous partisan, making sure the Republicans control the House and Senate so as to prevent his own impeachment, and what citizens can do to reform our democracy to make it harder for authoritarian populists like Trump to entrench their power. And joining us now is Barbara Crissett, the senior consulting editor and writer for Past Blue at the New School Graduate Program in International Studies and the United Nations correspondent for The Nation. And previously, she was the UN Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barbara Crissett.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me back.
Well, thank you, Barbara. And what's the buzz at the UN about Nikki Haley resigning? She went to the Oval Office and they had a photo op sitting with Donald Trump. He praised her profusely, but she's quitting at the end of the year. So what's going on?
Well, you know, there are so many conspiracy theories and so many people who are lying. It's the usual problem with Washington, but with this Trump White House in any case. Yes, it's not the first time he has praised someone fulsomely and then threw them, you know, in the ditch. So there are so many theories. One of the names that comes up a lot, and I have absolutely no any kind of, you know, sort of evidence to tell you about what his role is Vice President Pence. Several things about him is whether or not Nikki Haley was getting too close to him, whether she wanted to share her political advisor with him, and that was nixed in the White House. There is a persistent rumor. There are so many rumors, and, you know, 99.9% of them are not true. Is that Pence, and maybe even Haley, was involved in that op-ed page piece at the New York Times that talked about the dysfunction of the Trump administration and the need to, you know, think about what to do with him. So the ambassadors at the UN, for the most part, are saying what a great colleague she was, how she, you know, interacted with them. My suspicion is that she went to the UN, you know, saying she was going to sort of kick anyone who didn't vote. We're going to take names, you know, and all that stuff. And as she's smart, and the longer she was there, she seemed to understand how this thing works. But she became the fawner in chief during this period to President Trump. So when she tried to say yes, but or whatever, and she did huge things for the president and for the Republicans on next sanctions against Korea, North Korea. She took such a beating on the movement of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, but she never seemed to be rewarded is the wrong word, but acknowledged for all this work. They once in a while said the usual things, but, you know, ever since Rex Tillerson sidelined her, then Pence sidelined her, and Bolton, I think, has finished the job. Now, nobody knows what else is going on. Now, with Pence, if Trump were to replace Pence as his vice presidential candidate and put Haley in, that gives her a quicker route to the presidency, which is everybody at the UN thinks is what she's really after. So now she has her foreign policy ticket. But she has been treated shabbily, and she has she's even fought back on one or two occasions. So there's so many things at play here. But you keep hearing about Pence, you know, whether the two of them were not plotting, but were in contact a lot. And that President Trump, someone told me today, never trusted Pence. I mean, this is bizarre, but everything is bizarre now in our political life.
So there's two possibilities. One, that Trump could replace Pence in the 2020 race and put her in, and that would obviously help him enormously. Or two, Trump could get impeached, or the 25th Amendment could be invoked, Then she could run with Pence. And if she's a co-author of the op-ed in the New York Times, then that would be her reward. So let's sort of dispense with that speculation for a bit. And I'm talking with Barbara Cossette, the senior consulting editor and writer for Past Blue at the New School Graduate Program in International Studies and the United Nations correspondent for The Nation, and previously was the UN Bureau Chief for the New York Times. There is also, in terms of South Carolina politics, I just said we're going to dispense with speculation, but here I am speculating. She was down in South Carolina over the weekend. It's widely rumored, and I think it's quite likely that after the election, Lindsey Graham would replace the Attorney General, who's very unpopular, with Donald Trump. And that would then leave that Republican Senate seat open. So is that something that makes sense to you?
Yes, but it's also something that's talked about a lot because one of the things that Nikki Haley is lacking, if she wants to be president, but then, you know, so was Donald Trump, is any kind of national experience in Congress or any other, you know, cabinet position or something that would give her an insight into how Washington works. So that makes a lot of sense. And Lindsey Graham, who has, you know, to the progressive side of the political spectrum, disgraced himself over the Kavanaugh case, this would be his reward. And it could account for why he just simply caved, and now is trashing Kavanaugh's accuser. So, you know, that falls into place better than most anything else.
Right.
However, if I can add this, Trump, I was just watching recently in the last, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, Trump getting in or out off his helicopter, I don't know, it was approached by a bunch of reporters on the White House lawn, and we asked about who the replacements would be for Nikki Haley. Now, we can do that later, but that was interesting, too. He's all over the lot, and so no one knows if that, you know, the other part of the triangle wasn't finished. If it's Haley for Graham and Graham for Sessions, then who's for Haley? You know, that's what was left open, and that's what the reporters were after him to say.
Well, one of the names that's come up is Ivanka Trump.
Yeah, I know. He had to admit that would be nepotism. I mean, I'm surprised he can work on that word, but never mind. But then he also said, well, you know this. You probably saw the same thing I did. Kanye West, as a person who he seems to think connects with the world, Dina Powell is interesting. Dina Powell some people are saying, is the most qualified for this job. She was the Deputy National Security Advisor. She comes out of Goldman Sachs, and she went into working with McMaster, and then she left. CNN is showing a picture of Dina Powell and her husband and Nikki Haley and her husband on a boating expedition sort of around New York over the weekend also. So Haley was all over the place this weekend, this last weekend. So, I mean, they're all... And then Rick Grenell. I mean, Rick Grenell is the very controversial ambassador in Germany. He was disliked by everyone when he was spokesman in New York for the U.S. mission. And who knows how much Trump would want to, you know, sort of sock it to the Germans. So, I mean, all of these things... all of these things are up in the air. I mean, no one knows exactly why this happened, when it happened. Representative Mark Sanford was quoted this evening on the news here as saying the whole thing smells fishy. That is, the timing of this resignation smells fishy. So whatever that means.
Well, I guess if you sort of go through the steps here, if... the elections go as badly as people expect, or either way, frankly, I think Sessions would be fired. And there's a rumor that there's going to be a wholesale house cleaning, and even the last adult left in the room, Jim Mattis, might go. So if Lindsey Graham comes in to replace Sessions, he's got two more years on his seat. The governor of South Carolina could appoint Nikki Haley. She'd get 2 years of experience in the U.S. Senate. And then after that, she'd either, if Trump dumps Pence, she'd be his VP, or if Pence dumps Trump, she could be Pence's VP. So there you have the full picture, right, Barbara?
Yeah, right, exactly. It's a jigsaw puzzle, isn't it? I mean, this is the problem. But, you know, I think it's going to maybe things will shake out a bit. It really, at the moment, is a Washington story much more than a UN story. And I think this is one of the reasons that if Haley went of her own volition or because she was pushed, this is a different aspect. The UN bubble will have its own view. And as I said, ambassadors who are all diplomats, naturally, are saying what a great person she was. And, you know, even in the, within the, even in the Secretary General's office and even in, within other parts of the UN, they thought she was really trying to deliver the message of Trump with a civil face. And not, you know, she threatened, but this was what she thought she had to do. Now, you know, so, but everything is now shifted to Washington. And so most of what will happen or most of what will come out will probably come out of leaks from the White House or some other part of Washington, the Congress, less likely. But that, so it shows that Nikki Haley had been so sidelined that she's already gone. I mean, she's not leaving till the end of the year. And she's not... She doesn't have a big political base of her own. She is the daughter of Punjabi Sikh immigrants, but she has never played, as I can see it, the ethnic card, or she was never, she didn't produce the image of being exotic at the UN. I mean, my God, at the UN, everybody is exotic. So she doesn't have that either behind her. She really needs to build a political base. And maybe in the Senate she could. I mean, at least collect a few more supporters.
Well, it looks like in the short term, the hawks and the sycophants, Pompeo and Bolton, did her in. But I thank you for joining us, Barbara Cassett. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
And I've been speaking with Barbara Cassett, who is a senior consulting editor and writer for Past Blue at the New School Graduate Program in International Studies and the United Nations correspondent for The Nation, and previously she was the UN Bureau. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an analysis of the latest report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Stavins, a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School, and a lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Stavins.
It's good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Robert. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a group of scientists convened by the United Nations to guide world leaders, and you've been a part of it, of course, they've issued a new report that came out yesterday in Incheon, South Korea, which is incredibly alarming. So I guess the main point here is that we thought previously that the dire consequences of climate change would be manifest, if not irreversible, with a 3.6 degree rise in average temperatures. But now it turns out that the same consequences, the same dire consequences, will come much sooner at the 2.7 degree mark of a rise in temperature. So that means that we've got to make massive changes to our economy, to our way of life, and our understanding of how endangered this planet is. I mean, I think we're capable of doing it, but will we do it?
Well, I think that there are a couple of issues there. One is what can be done in a technological sense. Secondly, what is the cost of doing that? And then I guess the third issue is, given the cost, what are the political challenges of doing it? This report and the previous one from the Fifth Assessment Report make clear that what will be required in order to keep below even 2 degrees centigrade with the 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, and now this lower threshold they're talking about, which is 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit in this century, that what would be required to achieve that would involve the use of all available existing technologies, plus widespread dissemination and adoption of nuclear power, and possibly even some unknown technologies. In other words, it's going to be very, very difficult, and it's going to be very costly. Having said that, I think what one really needs to acknowledge is that it is unlikely that international negotiations, as they've proceeded thus far, are going to be capable of achieving that kind of global action. I say that, and would have said the same thing, even if the Trump administration was not in power and the U.S. was not threatening to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. So my bottom line on all of that, then, is that the real implication that I think needs to be taken from this report is that it is absolutely necessary and important to begin adaptation efforts to climate change, because climate change is taking place and is going to take place, and it's just not possible at this point in time to completely avert it.
Well, the report does try to put a price tag on the effects of climate change, and it estimates that the $54 trillion in damage from the 2.7 degrees of warming would grow to $69 trillion if the world continued to warm by 3.6 degrees and beyond. So that's the bad news, if in effect. But on the other side, the report details that the damage that would happen if governments fail to enact policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the United States would lose roughly 1.2% of its GDP for every 1.8 degrees of warming. So, in other words, the cost of adaptation is far, far less than the cost of the damage that will be done if we don't move to adapt and mitigate.
So it's true now, and it's been true for, you know, decades, that the cost of mitigation of reducing emissions is less than what the cost of the damages will be if action is not taken. That's why it makes sense to take action. However, it's very important to recognize that those damages are off in the future. This is a stock, not a flow, environmental problem. Greenhouse gases accumulate in the atmosphere, but the actions which need to be taken are upfront. So it's upfront costs with delayed benefits. That works exactly against what are the instincts and the history in representative democracies, where elected officials tend to give out current benefits and to place costs on future generations. This is asking politicians to do precisely the opposite of that. And that's why I say that we shouldn't be sanguine and think that existing political procedures are going to be able to deal with this problem before there are serious consequences setting in, which then may finally push the needle.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Stavins, who's a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School and the lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Well, we have an example of that in the political context here in California, Robert, with these upcoming midterm elections. The Republicans, who actually raised the taxes on California by denying the tax deductions for state and local taxes, are running on a campaign. Essentially, they put on the California ballot a repeal of the gas tax that raises gas in order to build roads and repair infrastructure. So they're running on a platform that you can't afford to have the price of gasoline go up. And the only way that we can wean ourselves from fossil fuel is to make it expensive, surely, or at least the logical thing would be to make it expensive, use that extra money to encourage alternatives.
Yeah, well, what's certainly true is that at the federal level and at most state levels, the price of gasoline is vastly lower now than it was earlier, and certainly gasoline taxes, since they haven't been increased in terms of real dollars, taking into account inflation, are actually less than they used to be. A major source of funding for highway expansion, highway maintenance and improvements have in fact been revenues from the sale of gasoline and other petroleum products. So it is certainly short-sighted and to pass up on improvements on infrastructure in order to save a bit on gasoline taxes. But the reality is that gasoline taxes are unfortunately highly salient to people, much more so than many other taxes, because they notice them every time they go to the pump each week. And therefore, there is tremendous resistance in the U.S., in many parts of the U.S., to higher taxes on gasoline.
So that, how do you get past that political impasse, if you will, that it's popular or it's unpopular to raise the price of fossil fuels, and coal is an even, I think, a worse example. How do you get past that political impasse?
Well, one of the things that's happening, which is good news, is that the cost of renewables has been coming down around the world, including in the United States. So wind and solar costs have been coming down. That's even putting aside the subsidies that come from the federal government and the programs in California. So that's good news, and that's one of the reasons why we've seen increasing reliance on renewable fuels within the electricity sector. The other factor that's been extremely important in this country, not in others, but in the United States, is the low price of natural gas. And that is a result of the combination of two technologies, hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling, sometimes referred to as fracking. That has opened up unconventional sources of natural gas in several different parts of the United States, across the United States, really. And that has dramatically changed the mix of coal and natural gas and electricity generation. And as a result of that, greenhouse gas emissions in the United States have been flat to declining in a series of years. So that's good news.
Well, when is the evidence? Not that the evidence is not manifest now with the droughts in Australia, the floods on the East Coast in the Carolinas, the hurricanes, one of which is about to hit the Florida Panhandle. with greater frequency and greater intensity. You just almost have to be blind not to recognize that something's happening to the climate and not the weather. There's a difference between climate and weather. And so at what point do you start losing Pacific islands? Bangladesh goes underwater, Florida goes underwater. Is that what it's going to take to wake us up? And I'd like to know from you what the estimate is by the time we get the wake-up call when seawater is lapping at the doorstep of President Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. Will it be too late?
Well, so I think the question is whether or not bottom-up demand from the population, broad-based, working through, you know, the Congress, working through the administration, is likely to lead to action before there are really horrific consequences. And my guess is that will only happen if there's political leadership that's really inspired. Now, I'm bipartisan. I've worked both with Republican and Democratic administrations, but I think it's reasonable to say that the previous administration in Washington, the Obama administration, was relatively aggressive on climate change policy action, and that the current administration in Washington, the Trump administration, is really an outlier in the opposite direction. I mean, it's an outlier internationally. There isn't another major country that is as opposed to action on climate, both domestically and in international participation, as this one. So I think, therefore, my answer to your question is that it's going to require a change in political leadership. We'll see what happens with the midterm elections, and we'll see what happens in the presidential elections in 2020.
And what about around the world? I mean, the Chinese seem to be aware of it, although they're still building coal-fired plants.
Well, there it's surprising. I mean, when President Trump announced on June 1st, back a year ago, his intention to withdraw from the Paris Agreement, which will only take effect in November of 2020, when he made that announcement, the greatest fear that many of us have that work in the international negotiations is the effect that would have on the large emerging economies, China, India, Brazil, Korea, South Africa, Mexico, and Indonesia, in terms of their contributions, their commitments internationally. It was expected that we would see them roll back. There wasn't a concern that it would affect the Europeans because they're very aggressive on this issue, and it was clear that they would continue forward. But somewhat surprisingly, China, India, Brazil, for example, Mexico as well, have not stepped back from the commitments, the pledges that they had already made under the Paris Agreement. So they're going forward. In fact, in the case of China, you know, China and the U.S. before were sort of the co-leaders in this effort during the Obama years. China seems to be quite happy to go from being a co-leader to the sole leader. And so the world is moving forward. Now, clearly, the initial set of pledges under the Paris Agreement are not enough to achieve 2 degrees C, let alone 1.5 degrees C, those two thresholds, the 3.6 and the 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. They're absolutely not. But it's only the first step. And so I would anticipate that in the next round of pledges, which will be forthcoming because under the Paris Agreement they redo the pledges every 5 years, they'll get even more ambitious. Whether the United States will be part of that action, that's a domestic political question.
But you mentioned Brazil. If the right-wing leader, Bolsonaro, is elected, and he did very well in the first runoff, in 3 weeks' time, they'll have another election. If he's elected, more of the Amazon rainforests will be cut down at a greater pace. The protections that the indigenous people have will be taken away. And my understanding is that the green forests of Brazil suck up something like 40% of the CO2. So if you cut them down, you're just accelerating climate change.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, exactly what the actions will be of the new government that's elected in Brazil, and then what that really means in terms of the rate of agricultural development in the Amazon. I mean, I think we have to be very careful about this. On the one hand, you're absolutely correct that the Amazon and other forests of the world are significant sequesterers of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as long as they're growing. But on the other hand, remember, for countries of the north, the industrialized world, such as the United States, to say to Brazil that they should not be converting some of their forests to agricultural land, you know, we did that in the 18th and 19th century, and it's a little hypocritical, I think, for us to think that we can condemn what are much poorer countries for wanting to follow exactly what the development path is that we use to get our thriving agriculture.
Well, since, I mean, it's in very simplistic terms, the way I understand it, Robert Stavins, is that, for example, the biggest reflectors of sunlight back into the atmosphere are the ice caps of the North and South Pole. And as they melt, less heat is reflected back into the atmosphere and more is absorbed in the atmosphere, and thus you get global warming. Because as the ice caps shrink, then the dark ocean gets bigger, and that has the opposite effect. So one of the solutions I heard was that if you paint every rooftop and every road white, is there anything we can do just in the immediate sense, let alone the economic challenges of getting off fossil fuels?
Well, so that takes me back to what I was mentioning before, which is adaptation. So making rooftops white rather than, you know, with black tar, painting them white, does indeed have a substantial cooling effect if it's done broadly enough. But I think that the phrase you have to keep in mind with climate change is all of the above. There isn't a silver bullet. It's not something like acid rain where there's a single technology or single fuel switch that's going to address the problem. The very economic development of the world over the last several hundred years was based upon the development and the burning of fossil fuels. So world economies now and people around the world are really depending upon fossil fuels, and it's going to take a lot of different actions, different policies, switching from coal to petroleum to natural gas to nuclear to renewables. It's going to take greater energy efficiency, and it's going to take adaptive measures in order to make the damages of climate change less severe. And cities around the world are now beginning to do that, because when you come to adaptation, it isn't a global commons problem. It's quite the opposite. It's very much a decision point, and action can be taken by localities. And that's now happening up and down the East Coast of the United States, and I would assume in parts of California as well.
Well, just in closing, one of the authors of this new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN body that's warning governments to act, Drew Schindel, a climate scientist at Duke University, said this report makes it clear there is no way to mitigate climate change without getting rid of coal. And he goes on to say that we are, for the short-term economic gain, they're endangering the life and the future of his grandchildren. I have a 2.5-year-old grandchild. What kind of world is she going to be looking at in 2040?
Well, I think one thing that should be recognized, and this now applies to the U.S., is that coal is the fuel of the past. And it's partly because of the climate change effects of CO2 emissions, but it's also because of the particulates that come from coal, the mercury that comes from coal. There are a whole set of environmental threats of coal. And for a considerable amount of time, because of some policy actions like the so-called mercury rule that EPA put through in the previous administration, but also simply because of relative prices, because technological change of natural gas, is that coal is really a fading industry. And despite what the president said during his presidential campaign, despite what he said since then when he's talking to coal miners, he's not going to bring coal back. Now, that's a different story in other parts of the world. In the developing world, it's a different story in Australia. But in the United States, at least, we are really moving away from coal at a relatively dramatic pace compared to how these things usually happen over time.
And just quickly, what kind of world do you think we'll have in 2040 for our grandkids?
Well, of course, you know, I don't know. You know, you try to look ahead that number of years, just go back that number of years and try to project what the world is going to be like. We wouldn't even think about such things as cell phones and a lot of the information technology we have. So we would make all sorts of mistakes. I'm an optimist, but I tend to see half full rather than half empty glass of water. I think there is going to be a necessity for adaptation. There is going to be climate change taking place. With damages from that. The worst damages are not going to be in the United States. They're not going to be in the rich countries of the world. They're going to be in those countries that depend upon agriculture for a large share of their income and gross domestic product. By definition, those are not the industrialized countries. Those are the developing countries.
Sure, but aren't they going to move here and move where they can move?
Well, so there is the likelihood of more pressure for immigration, particularly for Europe. Europeans are aware of that. That's not been a source of migration to the United States in the past. It's not clear that it will be in the future. But sub-Saharan Africa, people wanting to move north as a result of severe sustained droughts, there is a real possibility there. And Europeans are very concerned about that.
Well, Robert Stavins, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Stavins, who's a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School and a lead author of three reports by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing how the new Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh is likely to use his position on the court to be a zealous partisan, making sure the Republicans control the House and Senate so as to prevent his own impeachment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Azeez Haque, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And his latest book, just out, co-authored with Tom Ginsburg, is How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Azeez Haque.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thank you, Azeez. And, you know, obviously everybody on the progressive and liberal side, which is actually a majority in this country, if you go back to the election, Hillary Clinton got over 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. And some of the statistics now you're seeing about how the Republican Senate, I think, represents something like 140 million Americans, whereas the Democratic Senate, the losers in the Kavanaugh battle, represent something like 180 million Americans. So
right. There
are some structural imbalances in our Constitution, particularly with the Electoral College and the demographic changes underway, that will mean by 2040, the Republicans from the red states will control 70 seats in the Senate, whereas the Democrats in the blue states will only have 30 seats in the Senate, and by controlling the Senate, the Republicans will be able to control the court, which is what's been demonstrated in the last few days. So let me start with I want to talk about your book, but I'd like to also talk about your blog at Take Care, that Kavanaugh, because of the risk of impeachment, is going to become even more partisan. And frankly, Azeez, the ceremony that took place yesterday in the White House, which is largely a photo op, where he was sworn in for a second time, It was so partisan. Trump made the most outrageous partisan remarks, and so did Kavanaugh. So what's your fear here?
The process of confirming now Justice Kavanaugh has created an unprecedented situation in which there is a widely perceived connection between one justice and a particular partisan formation, a particular party, that goes above and beyond a shared ideology. I think any intelligent observer of the courts realizes that there's ideology and ideas and values that matter to judging. But what has happened in particular as a consequence of the fight over allegations of sexual abuse against Justice Kavanaugh is that Justice Kavanaugh's continued tenure in the court, in a very practical way, depends upon continued Republican control of both houses. And why is this? As many people have noted, there are statements that were key to Kavanaugh's defense against Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's allegations that were arguably, probably misleading or false. In particular, his claims about not drinking to the point of blackout are contradicted by a wide number of his college and high school acquaintances. If Justice Kavanaugh misrepresented, if he lied, if he committed perjury under oath in his confirmation hearings, this means that he's at risk of impeachment. And he should know this because the risk of impeachment has a precedent in the impeachment of William Clinton at the end of the last millennia for perjury under oath with respect to sexual conduct. Right. So this is this. We know that this is a basis for impeachment because this is the ground that the Republicans used against Clinton. And we also know that impeachment's only going to happen now if Democrats have control over the House and the Senate. So Kavanaugh knows that he is at risk of impeachment if and only if Democrats control the House and the Senate. That means he has a personal and direct interest in the maintenance of Republican control of both houses. This is an unprecedented kind of linkage between a sitting Supreme Court justice and a political party in control of both the House and the Senate. It is, to my mind, something that is utterly inconsistent with democratic values. And because of the power that a Supreme Court justice wields, it is a real threat to democratic competition at the national level.
Well, in your new book, How to Save a Constitutional Democracy, you argue that the sobering reality for the United States is that, to a much greater extent than is commonly realized, the Constitution's design make democratic erosion more, not less likely. Its structural rigidity has had the unforeseen consequence of empowering the Supreme Court to fill in some details, often with doctrines that ultimately facilitate rather than inhibit the infringement of rights. So explain that in the context of what we're talking about with Kavanaugh.
So let me step back as a way of explaining this and give you a couple of sentences of context. What we try and do in How to Save a Constitutional Democracy is to look at how democratic decline has happened in other countries around the world in the last 10 or 15 years, and to try and draw lessons about how vulnerable the United States is, given on what we see overseas. Overseas, we see a consistent pattern of legal and constitutional tools being employed by usually populist parties that have seized political power in order to unravel or limit democratic competition and entrench themselves in power. So one important lesson is that law and constitutions, which are often associated with the promotion of democracy, turn out to be double-edged tools. It's often possible to misuse or to twist around laws and constitutional tools as ways to undermine the force of democracy. And if we look at the suite of tools that are commonly used around the world, which include control of the judiciary, the undermining of opposition parties, the capture of the public sphere, the attacks upon independent elements within government, many but not all of those measures are enabled or allowed by the U.S. Constitution. So if we think about the threat to democracy in terms of how that threat has materialized elsewhere, we see that the Constitution does not materially impede that threat.
So you didn't mention freedom of the press being under attack, which it is here in the United States, with the President of the United States referring to the press as the enemy of the American people. Is that to say that the First Amendment is solid, immovable, impenetrable?
No, you're absolutely right to say that. First of all, a variety of kinds of attacks on the press are observed in other countries where you've had democratic backsliding. And at least some of those forms of attack are ways or pathways that are perfectly available in the United States. So, for example, in both Turkey and in Hungary, the populist governments have used regulation. They've used anti-competition laws to squeeze out of business companies that were either that owned newspapers that printed news that was not dictated or sympathetic to the government, or squeezed out of business companies that provided facilities that opposition politicians relied upon. So an example of that is in Hungary, where the company that owned many of the billboards across Hungary was put out of business by a regulatory measure by the Fidesz government there, with the result that the opposition party can no longer – there is no company that will give the Hungarian opposition space on public billboards to advertise itself. So the only images you see of politicians in Hungary today are images of the ruling Fidesz party and its ruler, Viktor Orban. Measures like that in the United States, right, the misuse of regulatory powers, for example, by in decisions about whether to allow mergers between different entities, particularly, for example, in the cable and telecommunications business, are very easy to accomplish. There are other measures that are also easy to accomplish. For example, there is no restraint in U.S. law on either verbal attacks of the kind that you described on the press or in outright slander, right? So there are a couple of cases in which journalists have been targeted by officials within the White House with false and derogatory information. Right. And if it was a private party that did that, there'd be a remedy under law. But there is no remedy for that kind of targeted picking out of journalists when the perpetrator is a federal government actor. Just because there are some protections under the First Amendment for journalists, and absolutely there are some protections, right, doesn't mean that those protections are complete or robust or cannot be worked around.
Well, there are reports from the White House, from Axios, for example, which is a very, very good insider operation. I think they seem to get the most interesting insight into what's happening. I don't know how Jonathan Swan does it, but he seems to have amazing sources. He was saying the other day that Trump is so thrilled about getting Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on the court, and that, after all, is his main achievements, that he's running around sort of gleefully saying, "I could get two more. I could get two more." Ruth Bader Ginsburg is, you know, getting old, and Sotomayor is, you know, she's a diabetic and she's overweight. Putting aside how grotesque that is, if indeed these reports are true, just in the broader sense, going back to what I said earlier about the demographic changes in the Electoral College will have the effect that the Republicans will, into the future, be able to dominate the Senate and therefore dominate the courts if they haven't already done that.
Right. I think this is a deep problem with the design of the Senate and the U.S. Constitution, that it provides whatever political faction happens to be in the states that are overrepresented, when measured on a population baseline, which at the moment tends to be rural, Midwestern and southern states, with a disproportionate amount of political power. And that means that the Senate is always going to be tilted toward, or at least for the foreseeable future, is going to be tilted toward the right in ways that push the court toward the right. And note that that's even true when the president is a Democrat, right? That because the president has to get his or her nominee through the Senate, regardless of whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. And notice also that the bias that you've described in the Senate's representation doesn't just affect what the Senate itself does, but because the Senate and the measure of how many people are in the Senate is part of the formula that goes to make up the Electoral College, the bias in the Senate also biases the identity of the president away from whoever the popular vote winner is, right? You mentioned that Trump didn't win the popular vote, and the distorted structure of the Senate is part of the reason for that. This, I think, means that the court is going to tend rightward for the foreseeable future. And if I was a progressive politician or reformer thinking about what to do, particularly about the court, right? And the Senate and the Electoral College are separate problems, right? But if you're just focused on the court, I think that the best strategy is to find ways to limit the court's role in American life, because if we tot up the ways in which the court has contributed over time to progressive causes, right? The sense in which they've aided the underdogs, the people who are marginalized or who are relatively powerless in American society. And you look at, on the other hand, at how many times they help they comfort the comfortable and afflict the afflicted. The second column is much more full than the first column. There's no reason to think that's going to change in the future. And if the court overall ends up being a force for worse rather than for better in national life, and there's no real way of structurally changing that, there are ample ways of reducing the ability of the court to intervene in American public life in ways that are destructive.
And what are they?
A couple of different examples. One is the Constitution says that there has to be a Supreme Court, but doesn't actually say that much about what cases it has to hear. Over history, the court has had very different responsibilities with respect to cases arising in federal courts and in lower federal courts. And it's possible to imagine today that the court's jurisdiction would be dramatically restricted in ways that limit its ability, in particular, to unravel progressive federal statutes. Right, so I'm thinking here of the attacks that the court has mounted, even prior to Justice Kavanaugh's elevation, on statutes like the Affordable Care Act and the Clean Air Act. Right, there are ways of limiting the court's ability to disrupt these progressive programs that take the form of changing its jurisdiction over such cases.
So, do you see then, given the trajectory we're on with a permanent Republican control of the Senate and therefore the courts, does that mean that we have a very narrow window to elect enough Democrats to the Senate to get past a filibuster-proof margin to do certain things? Like, for example, you could make Puerto Rico a state that would pick up two Democratic Senates. You could make Washington, D.C. a state. There are certain short-term fixes that I see. I don't know whether there are any others that you come to your mind, but it seems to me that the challenges are so huge because on the right in this country, you've got the Koch brothers and other powerful plutocrats who are getting behind a constitutional convention, a convention of the states, and they're very close to getting the two-thirds majority of the state legislature signed
up. Right, absolutely. Absolutely.
And
it's hard to see how a constitutional convention, which is, as you rightly say, largely propelled so far by Koch brothers' money, resulting in any kind of progressive set of changes to the constitution structure of the kind that you identified, right? Adding representation for D.C., for Puerto Rico, altering the population-based the deviation from population-based equality that's represented in the Senate. So I think those things are unlikely. I think that what's more likely to happen as a strategic matter is so I think there's two things that are worth bearing in mind that I think complicate the picture. The first is that the nature of the coalition represented by each of the parties changes over time, and it is actually in the last 2 weeks is among the many grotesque things that have happened, possible to see the Republican Party becoming an even narrower coalition than it's been, one focused upon a particular ethnic and gender slice of the population, and the Democrats becoming more and more of a broad tent, right? And you can imagine that the changing circumference of the party's narrow or broad tent changes the electoral calculus in some states, right? At least for the purpose of the Senate. So I wouldn't give up on the idea of many states actually being competitive in the near term. It just depends upon the parties. The other thing that's happening is demographics, right? So the baby boomers are increasingly becoming elderly and becoming an increasingly smaller slice of the voting age population. And the voting age population is increasingly made up of people who are in their 20s and 30s, who overwhelmingly are, if they don't identify as Democrats, they're committed to they've already internalized many ideas of social justice that I think were in a way that was not true 20 or 30 years ago, right? So parties change, demographies change, and those changes have to be accounted for in thinking about the trajectory of the Senate and therefore the courts. And it may be that the easier thing for progressives to do is to alter the scale or the size of their coalitions to attract more young people than to get into the weeds of a fight with the Koch brothers over a constitutional amendment.
Well, Aziz Haque, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
No, thank you, Ian, for having me on, and thank you for talking about these really important issues.
And again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is a co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And his latest book, co-authored with Tom Ginsburg, just out, is How to Save a Constitutional Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.